Live from British Columbia, Canada. Welcome to the Maple Minds podcast. I'm Christy. That's Sherry. That's Polly. We're three ladies who like to talk about politics, and we do it live every Tuesday and Friday at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern. Make sure you are following our TikTok page as well as being subscribed to our YouTube channel, and you can see any of our old shows on the YouTube channel. Let's start with federal politics, and we're going to start talking about Pierre Poilievre. Specifically, I'd like to start talking about why everybody believes that we should be able to stop talking about Pierre Poilievre, and we should have to stop listening to Pierre Poilievre. Why is press still giving him airspace? Why is he acting like he's still employed when the perception is that he has been fired by Canada? Go ahead.
It's very simple. The party leader, the leader of the opposition, and the leader of the House can be three separate people. The way the legislation is written around this is that the leader of the opposition has to have a seat in Parliament, but the party leader doesn't have to be. And even though he's not a sitting member, like he didn't win a seat, he's still the party leader of the CPC. Until the membership decides to get rid of him, he is still the leader of the party. We just don't pay him. The CPC would be paying him, or he's going without a salary, one or the other. I'm not sure which. I've been trying to look for that information and I haven't been able to find it anywhere, but he is not being paid by us.
Yeah.
We're talking quite a few years ago now, and with inflation and the cost of goods and stuff rising and services rising, that could be $25,000 to $30,000 more. Instead of $20,000, it could be $25,000 now. And that's $100,000 for 4 months, 5 months.
Yeah, especially because he is so likely to win the by-election because they had favored so heavily towards the Conservatives. I think if he loses the by-election or he steps down as leader, then sure, then kick him out. While the likelihood of this happening within months is there, I think it's a waste of time, and I think it's petty to try to kick the guy with little kids out of the house. If it wasn't likely that he was going to move in, I'd be singing a different song.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case, right?
Yeah. I don't think the little kids angle should be used, though, because they're not elected officials. I get what you're saying from an empathetic perspective, but it really shouldn't factor into the decision here. We just need to be within the rules. And unfortunately, this has exposed a loophole. And the other thing too is that Andrew Scheer, as interim leader of the opposition, could very well say, I want to live in Stornoway, in which case Pierre would have to get out.
He said he wouldn't.
Yeah, but the fact that Scheer doesn't want to, I don't think he should get his housing allowance. That's what I think. Or the CPC should be paying his housing allowance. Because Stornoway is attached to the leader of the opposition. So no matter who the leader of the opposition is, they get free housing on the taxpayer's dime. It doesn't matter to me who sits in that house, but we should only be paying for one of them.
I agree. Yeah.
If Andrew wants to forego that honor.
Do they pay it while they're already paying for Stornoway?
Yes. Andrew gets a housing allowance as an MP because his home is in Saskatchewan. So he gets paid a housing allowance. They have that perk where they get a housing allowance to live closer to Parliament while Parliament's in session. It's part of the MP.
That's just for the leader.
No, every MP.
Okay. So, but he's an MP anyways.
No. Every MP gets housing allowance.
Okay.
Andrew Scheer is technically the interim leader of the opposition right now. He would get Stornoway, not a housing allowance on top of Stornoway. But because he's not staying in Stornoway, he still gets a housing allowance to live in Ottawa. We're paying for Pierre to live in the housing. We shouldn't be paying for both, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So if Andrew wants to forego living in Stornoway, fine.
But he should take up a spare room at Stornoway when he's in town to do business.
Yeah.
And maybe Pierre can get up early and make him some bacon.
Yeah. And I think that's perfectly acceptable. But the party itself should be paying for Scheer's housing allowance until Andrew is not interim leader anymore.
I agree. And I also agree with what you said about not bringing kids into it. Totally fair point. And I won't bring it up again. And
Yeah.
Totally fair point. I'd also like to address when people, they get very angry with the media for calling him the leader of the conservative opposition. I think it's fair to say that. Here's the thing. I'm going to address maybe Debbie made a video because he was fired. He was voted out so that you can't call him that anymore. But the thing is, he wasn't voted out by the conservatives yet. And by the way, if anybody wants to bet me on that, I have a side bet going. Just Christie, not Maple Mines related, but Just Christie is betting that Pierre won't make it to Christmas. Yeah. So if you went in on that bet, please get in touch with me. I'll let you know the details. It's not for money. It's just for glory. So one of two things could happen there. And this has nothing to do with the people in Carleton, and it has nothing to do with all Canadians. It only has to do with the people who have the right to vote within the Conservative Party about their leader.
Us complaining about Pierre still being party leader is like how they complained about Mark Carney being party leader.
It is exactly literally the exact same thing.
Yeah. The only thing that's the difference is that the prime minister's position and the leader of the opposition position have different requirements. And so when you're in parliament, the leader of the opposition is a parliamentary position, which is why it has to be a sitting MP, because their sole job is to hold the government to account. The difference with the prime minister is the prime minister can't pass anything without the confidence of the House. So it doesn't matter whether he has a vote or not. He can't do anything unless he's got the confidence of the House. And that's why the two seats are different within Parliament. But as far as party leader, it's no different. And until the CPC party decides to vote Pierre out, which I'm beginning to think more and more they won't. And as much as we despise Pierre, we can't let that cloud our judgment and make us hypocrites as well.
Here's the thing. My desire to never, ever watch or hear Pierre Poilievre again, strong. Let me tell you something. There's almost nothing I want more than to not have to hear from that guy again.
Yeah.
But what I want more than that is consistency. And if I wouldn't accept it from the Liberals, do you know what I mean? And it is exactly the same. Mark Carney was able to be the leader of that party without having a seat, because being the leader of the party and being in the House are two different things.
Really interesting is that this isn't the first time this has happened. In fact, we're seeing this right now in British Columbia. We have an interim leader for the BC Greens because Sonia Firstuneau lost her seat. Jeremy Velotti is the interim leader of the BC Green Party because he has a seat and Sonia doesn't, but she's still party leader. Danielle Smith was the leader of the UCP without a seat until they had a general election. Nenshi is without a seat in Alberta, even though he has been the leader of the NDP. Jagmeet Singh was the leader of the federal NDP in 2017 to 2019 without a seat in parliament. I don't understand why this is confusing for people to wrap their heads around, because we've seen it play out. I don't know if it's because people just weren't paying attention before, or they, or
I think emotion really,
or is it really because of Pierre?
I think it's because of Pierre. I think that the hatred for him is so strong that they're not considering what the way it really is.
Yeah.
I believe a couple of things. If you are a Carney supporter and you're saying this about Pierre, I think you can say that I wish I didn't have to listen to him anymore, but you can't say we shouldn't have to, because it's factually incorrect. And I think that when you present information that is incorrect, I think it chips away at your credibility. And then less people are going to listen to you about the other stuff that is correct.
Well,
number one,
this idea that you can only criticize the government if you're an elected official is wrong, because we have advocates who get press time all the time who criticize the government, right? Like, they hold press conferences. Look at First Nations right now. They're not elected officials and they're criticizing governments, and they have that right to do that. And that's the thing about living in a democracy, is that we have to remember that we may not always like it, but it has to be the same across both sides in order for it to be a functioning democracy.
And we need to have opposition. I disagree so strongly with the way that Pierre presents the opposition because of all of the bullshit. But at the end of the day, you can't have somebody putting stuff forward with nobody opposing. That is good for nobody at all.
Yeah. And it's really interesting that the lack of confidence he has in Scheer to be able to take these things on.
Yep. Scheer. It's valid.
Yeah.
Just saying.
But you know what? This also works to our advantage because people are mad. They're mad that Pierre still has a say. They're mad that he's still in front of cameras. They're mad that he's living at Stornoway. They're furious that he's still a relevant voice in politics. And every time he gets in front of a mic right now and he goes back to the same old tired bullshit that he's been peddling for the last 2 to 3 years, people just roll their eyes, and it just cements even more how much they dislike him. And more and more people are starting to look at him as a big fat hypocrite. Even people who supported him before maybe are starting to look at him as a hypocrite because he is not walking the walk. You walk the walk, you talk the talk. He is not walking his talk. He is sitting there at the podium and saying that Sean Fraser is good at failing upwards. It's like, dude,
the guy didn't even win his seat.
Dude, are you kidding me? You're the prime example of failing upwards right now. Anybody else in your position at any other time in that party would have lost their leadership already. You would have been out.
Now, I know that this wasn't on the agenda, but I think it is important to touch on the budget. So the Liberals said, you know what, there isn't going to be a spring budget. However, there's going to be communication in the fall. And I can't remember how they worded it.
It's the fall economic update.
Okay.
We get it every year.
Yeah. So here's the thing. A lot of conservatives, and Pierre really went, Pierre, no budget, no plan, no seat, dude. Here's the thing. It's a brand new government. I don't believe it is common. I believe it's common to have a spring budget. I don't believe it's common to have a brand new government come up with a spring budget this quickly.
No. And you know what? A lot of the spending that's, I just had a fight with somebody online who's, not really a fight. I shut her down and you'll know who it is. If I'm not going to say her name, but you know who she is. She's always consistently wrong. And then when you point out that she's wrong, she either fights harder or she takes off.
Dude, that could be anybody. Come on.
Anyways. She was all up in the comment section. She tried to pick a fight with me again. And it was just like, I just said to her, you don't understand the fiscal procedures for government. And that's the thing is that these people, they don't research. They don't look things up. It's very common to have spending. Like they were going on and on about the $40 billion that was approved. And it wasn't voted on. And they weren't sitting in the House. But here's the thing. Those decisions were made last fall. And everybody voted on them last fall. And the rules are, if you don't have a budget in the spring, yes, it's normal to have one, but there's no rules that says you have to have one. And there's no law that says you have to produce one by the spring. And if you don't produce a new budget, you just keep on with the old budget.
Something budget related is happening in the United States right now. So anybody who is paying attention to that might think it's the same thing. And that's where certain information has to be put forward to Congress for their budget a certain day. And that is the law in their country. Having a spring budget put forward by the Canadian government is not law. And like Sherry said, and it would be like that with any business. There's a lot of businesses who miss budgets and just go by old budgets until the new ones are communicated. It's not as uncommon as Pierre Poilievre is putting out there.
Yeah. And you know what? Pierre knows this because they voted on a lot of this spending in the fall.
Yeah. He also knows that what isn't common knowledge to people, he knows how many people are going to have an emotional response without looking into it. And that's what he's banking on.
Yeah. It always goes back to the fact that a vast majority of voting population doesn't know how government works in our country. They just don't.
Yeah.
And yet doesn't matter how many websites we put out there, how many times we tell them to go to our comments, how many times you say the information is there, you just got to look it up. They refuse to do so because it's easier to be rageful and spread mis and disinformation than it is to be principled and go look things up and understand the things that you're talking about.
That's a great segue into talking about the things that are being said about the housing minister, somebody that everybody in this room is familiar with since he was the mayor of Vancouver for 1 month shy of a decade. Two things. Number one, he is being blamed for the housing affordability challenge in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And number two, it's being presented that he is saying that he's against lowering prices. He wants the prices to be higher. That's what they're saying about him. So
That's not what he said, but yeah.
No, that's not what he said, but that's what other people are, how they're presenting it.
Yeah.
That's my point. So let's first talk about his record in housing and why he is not to blame.
Okay. The thing is that the mayor doesn't have a lot of legislative power, and the legislative power at the municipal level comes from the city council. So things like zoning and permits and development fees, those are all voted on by the city council together collectively. And then majority rules, right? It's democracy in action. The mayor only has one vote on city council, just like all the city councilors do. And there's only so much that a municipality can do. Now, while social housing does fall under the municipality, I will point out that Gregor Roberts did increase shelter spaces, and he did increase low-income housing in the city.
Co-ops.
And emergency housing for all those modular homes that were in the parking lot down on False Creek there, for those who are disenfranchised, those people. He did do those things. However, municipalities depend on the provincial government and the federal government to fund those initiatives as well, because they can't raise enough money within the city to pay for those. Even in a big city like Vancouver, you can only have so many parking meters, so many development fees, and so many property tax raises before people start to get really upset. Right. And so they did raise property taxes in that time. They raised business property taxes in that time. They raised development fees in that time, all to try and pay for some more social housing and other initiatives to help affordability in the city. They don't have any power over how many foreign investors were buying up.
I'm going to get to the foreign investors in a second, and the other contributing factors to why the housing prices did what they did. But I will say, when you're talking about increasing taxes to pay for social housing, another thing that Robertson did towards the end of his mayorship was he was the first politician in North America to implement a speculation and vacancy tax. It's a tax that had it been implemented in France. And I think France was the first one to do it in 99. Yeah. And some other areas had done it. But in North America, nobody had done it before. Gregor had done it for Vancouver in 2017. Because of that tax, they were able to raise $142 million towards social housing.
Yes. And they also put 5,400 empty units back on the rental market. So he did do some things to try and combat, but unfortunately what was happening at the time, our provincial government didn't care. Christy Clark just wanted to build. He had no control over them marketing condos in Hong Kong. He had no control over her lack of Airbnb policy. He had no control over the rent evictions and the rental legislation in the province. He didn't have any control over those things. His job is supply. That's what he does have control over. And he did okay. He didn't do fantastic. He wasn't earth shattering. He did promise to end homelessness and he didn't, but he tried. He did try to a degree. One thing I will criticize him for, though, was the lack of taxes on development property that businesses got away with not paying, because that was within his control. Like all of those shitty little community gardens with the gravel all over and a park bench in it, and they called it a community garden, and then they only had to pay a dollar's worth of taxes for the year or whatever. That was ridiculous.
I agree.
And the fact that he wouldn't sell property that Vancouver owned in order to build social housing, I will criticize him on that for. But the rise in prices in Vancouver, you can't criticize him for the rise in prices when both on either side, North Van and Richmond, both had similar increases in their property values and development fees. And they're the municipalities on either side of Vancouver. Burnaby yeah. also.
And actually, so another thing that had contributed to it was low interest rates. But I just want to talk about the rise too. So I did just a little experiment. And I was looking up which area rose the most. From 2008 to today, Vancouver is at 120%. From 2008 to today, what do you think Chilliwack's at?
Oh, I would say close to 200%.
163%. For anybody outside of BC, Chilliwack is outside of the Lower Mainland. It's in the valley. It's a little more than an hour away. They exploded during the pandemic too, when a lot of people had left the city. Yeah, well, big increases in BC. He was only the mayor of one city, and we saw the price explosion in all of the surrounding cities. Another thing that happened, Sherry talked about the foreign investors. In 2015, it was revealed that it was 33%. 33% of Vancouver real estate was being bought by people who lived in mainland China. When you have an economic principle of supply and demand, and then you increase the supply by the size of China, it's going to drive prices.
We all remember the students who were qualifying for mortgages and the housewives without any income buying
mansions.
West Van. I remember the one I remember the most was the 18-year-old kid in West Van who was living in a $5 million mansion and had a $200,000 car in the driveway, and he was listed as a student.
Yeah.
And then we found out more when David Eby did the money laundering inquiry. We found out that there was a ton of money laundering happening. And at that time, again, I want to point out, up until November 2015, who was in charge provincially and federally?
Conservatives.
Yeah.
Yep.
And who was in charge of the CMHC portfolio and housing?
Pierre Poilievre.
Yeah. So it's it's very rich for him to be standing at the podium.
Oh, yeah.
Pointing fingers at Robinson when Harper and Christie were nowhere to be found for helping Vancouver.
Yep.
They didn't care.
And here's the thing, everybody was making so much money, that's why they didn't step in. But another thing that had contributed to it was way lower than normal interest rates. I'm not talking about really favorable times. I'm talking about almost free. They were at 0.5%, which is, I think, the closest to free that you're going to get for years. And he started with 1.5%. And then the year after that, it dropped to 0.5%.
Yeah.
And then by the time he left, it was still under 2%. That's a decade of interest rates that are under 2%. Most of the time it was 1% or less. Yeah. That's not normal. And that's going to drive a lot more buyers than they would have houses for.
And you also have to factor in the Olympics effect.
Yes.
Every city that's ever hosted an Olympic event, the people have been worse off financially after the event is over. And we saw a massive influx of people coming in and snapping up 400 square foot condos and turning around and holding onto them like piggy banks because they knew that the Olympics were coming and prices would go up. There were so many things that were happening. Like, it was the perfect storm. And we were ground zero. I always say to people, you don't have to tell me about the housing crisis. We're patient zero in Vancouver.
We are patient zero.
Out of that, too, was the 2008 financial crisis where the housing bubbles burst. And then you had hedge funds and asset management companies and consortiums and REITs going around buying up dirt cheap property, speculating that the prices were going to rise. And they didn't just do it in Vancouver. They did it in Sydney. They did it in Venice. They did it in New Orleans. They did it in San Francisco, in California, and Toronto. Like, we were just happened to be the very first jurisdiction in Canada that was affected by all of this. And then it spread out across Canada. It wasn't until it started to affect Ontario that anybody really cared anymore. Even Trudeau, when he first came to office, he didn't put together a housing plan until 2017. And the reason why I know this is because I was so at the end of my rope in 2015 around housing. I was involved with Vancouver is Falling, which is a Facebook group that was all about housing advocacy. I was involved with the tenants union. I was living and breathing this stuff. And when Trudeau was elected, I remember feeling, oh my God, finally, somebody's going to be paying attention to us at NBC, because it felt so lonely out here. It felt so lonely, like nobody cared. And then Trudeau didn't do anything either until 2017. But to sit there and blame Gregor for the housing prices in Vancouver is disingenuous.
Not only is it disingenuous, it's a, pardon me, dick move. Yeah. This guy just took over as housing minister at a time where housing affordability is top of everybody's minds. And Pierre is casting doubt already just because he's from the other team. We haven't even talked about his comment about, no, the prices aren't going down.
And so that also was taken out of context. And I will say, and I did say this in a video, that if I want to fault Gregor for anything, it was not realizing that the press would have a field day with that. I also mentioned that 2018 media is not the same as 2025 media. The media is a lot more negative now. They're looking for sound bites. They're looking for gotcha moments. They're looking to cast doubt, and they're looking to
go viral.
Tear people apart and go viral.
They're looking to go viral. So you have to be careful about the clips that you give them, how they're going to be perceived. And that's something that he didn't consider.
No.
But for everybody who's saying that the prices, they have to come down, then by how much do you punish the people who just bought at these prices?
Yeah.
They're going to have to be paying a mortgage that's greater than the value of their house. This isn't just about the Gen Xers and boomers who have their entire wealth tied up in their equity. It's about the people who bought at these inflated prices. What are you going to do? You're going to tell the bank, oh, the prices have all gone down, so I don't owe you that much money anymore. That's not how it works, man.
No. I remember, I don't know if you remember when the housing bubble burst in Ontario and in the suburbs of Toronto, people were stuck. Their houses went underwater. They ended up owing the bank more than the equity was in their house. And it was awful. It was really hard. And it also happened in the 80s here in the condo market. It happened in the 80s. I think it was the 80s, 90s, where the bottom fell out of the condo market in British Columbia. Same idea. People had bought at really elevated prices, and now they owed the bank more than what their condo was worth. That's where you get people walking away because they can't afford the mortgage or they can't get out from underneath anymore. We've gotten to this point where we just vilify anybody who owns a house. And that's not the people that we should be mad at.
It's not
my parents who worked all their lives to own a house and they happen to flip up to a property now that's worth over $1 million. It's not people who own a house and a cottage. When we talk about people who are the 1%, we're talking like Blackstone. We're talking like people who own multiple properties and are collecting passive income. Those are owner class people, not somebody who owns a house.
No, the problem is, I believe that we should limit how many houses somebody should be able to own. I think it's ridiculous that in our country, 1 in 5 houses is owned by somebody who doesn't need a house when there's such a problem with people who need houses. Yep. Now, here's the thing. There's somebody who said, how do you offer affordable housing without lowering the prices? Yep. And I think it's where you put the houses, right? They talked about wartime houses and prefabricated houses. The reason I brought up Chilliwack before is when I was in my 20s, that's where my boss tried to get me to buy. Mm-hmm. He was like an uncle, and he's, Christie, don't buy in the city, buy out near Chilliwack because your property value is going to increase more out there than it is here. If you go on the outskirts of town where the next town is likely to be popping up, your house value is going to increase more. Now, here's the thing. The privilege of owning a house isn't just about having a roof over your head. That's not where all of the desire to be a homeowner comes from. It's from the investment as well. Mm-hmm. If you just chop all the prices to make it affordable for everybody else, what are you doing to the other 66% of the country? Do you know what I mean? I think it sets a bad precedence. And then people who are happy to have it at that, then what are they hoping? They're hoping it appreciates. But then what happens to the other generation? Do you want your equity chopped in half so that they can afford it? They should be able to afford it. I think you should be able to give them an option, but you have to keep the greedy rich away. And pardon me. And that's the key, because when you offer something affordable, all the investors swoop in and they buy it up, and then you're no further ahead. Yeah. You're just contributing to the problem worse. And you have to stop those guys from buying it and make sure that the people who are buying them are the people who need them.
And that is absolutely the problem, is that a lot of the supply that was built in Vancouver was not protected. I remember one person telling me that they lived in a condo that was one third empty. Investors had swooped in and bought a bunch of pre-sales. I remember one where they turned them all into Airbnbs, and then the family had bought the condos in the building, had ousted the strata board, and then installed all their family members that owned Airbnbs in the condo building on the strata board.
Dang.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. You're always going to have greedy people. You're always going to have scammers. You're always going to have grifters. As long as there's people, you're going to have those people. The best way is just to put rules in place and put consequences in place to try to discourage it. But it's always going to happen. But we should be moving on, because we only got 20 minutes left and we're only on our second thing.
So Gregor is not at fault. Pierre's a hypocrite for trying to point the finger at him. And Pierre's got to be careful, because he was the housing minister while those prices were skyrocketing.
Yes. All right. Let's talk quickly about Terrebonne.
Oh, yeah. I smell something fishy. So, I'm sorry. I do.
Here's the situation in Terrebonne. The Bloc is pushing for another by-election to say, hey, there's too many fishy things going on. Elections Canada admitted that they had made a mistake. If they didn't admit that, I think something's fishy. I do.
Okay, here's my problem with it. When you mass produce envelopes like that, how can it only be six have misprinted postal codes?
Yeah.
Why isn't there at least 100 people coming forward saying, I had my mail-in ballot returned?
Yeah.
Why isn't that happening? You can't tell me that only three or four out of a batch of thousands, they probably ordered them in batches of 1,000 to 5,000, right?
Yeah.
You can't tell me that in one print, only six ended up with the wrong postal code.
I think it needs to be investigated further, but if they can't, what happened? I don't believe it's the people who had the votes that were being shady.
No.
If anything, I think that they have to have another one. Do you disagree?
I do. Yeah. Because they can't prove the ones that showed up at Elections Canada office. There's no way to know if they actually tried to mail those in or not. There's no time stamp, date stamp on them at all. And I don't think that for one vote with one return to sender, I don't think one vote balances out a $2 million by-election. It doesn't really change the balance of power too much in Parliament. It's not like the Bloc going from 22 to 23 seats gives them any more leverage.
I agree that there's no power, but I disagree that there's no advantage, because I think more representation is the advantage. The difference is your guy having the opportunity to be in the House versus the other guy.
Yeah. It doesn't really matter. Blanchette is taking them to court. So that's going to cost us money anyways.
The wide stand. You ever see how wide that guy stands?
Yeah. He's taking them to court. So Canada's going to have to pay for legal fees for the court case. I don't think it warrants $2 million worth of taxpayer dollars to call a new election. I don't. But we'll have to wait and see what the judicial branch has to say about it, because nobody has that power. Elections Canada doesn't have that power. And as for the other votes that have shown up at the elections office, like I said, Elections Canada said there's no proof that they didn't come in after the deadline, because they showed up after the deadline. There's no proof. And you've only got one that says that it was a bad postal code. Were there any mail-in votes in Terrebonne? Were there any mail-in votes? Obviously there were. So how can it only be one that has a bad postal code on it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's what I think. I think it's fishy too. But we wait and see what it comes back as.
Yeah, we'll see what the courts have to say on it.
So now, do you want to talk about EB, or do you want to go to Trump's big, beautiful bill that failed?
I think we should talk about Evie because of the Indigenous component to it. And with the things that are going on in Alberta, I think it's important that we talk about those things. They do impact our whole country.
Go ahead.
And they, okay. So anyways, Bill 15 is a fast track bill that gives the NDP power to fast track projects that are seen as advantageous for the province. The problem, I was just reading about it in the Walrus before we came on. It seems that a lot of the issue around Bill 15 is the wording of it and the ambiguity of it. And the fact that they didn't consult with Indigenous before they wrote the bill, which the Indigenous populations are saying that is what they're upset about, is that they weren't consulted before the bill was written. Now, EB has come out and said that this bill does not apply to LNG products, projects, or pipelines, and it absolutely includes Indigenous consultation on those projects that are being fast-tracked. However, there is some loose language within the bill that people, there was a lot of possibility and it could and it might when they were reporting on it. So there's a lot of speculation attached to the bill that says in the wrong hands, it could do this. In the wrong hands, it could do that. It could open the door for this. It might open the door for that. So it's, but the Green Party members are not going to vote for it. The two Green Party members, they're going to vote against it. And he's made it a non-confidence vote.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He did make it, and he wants to push it through before May 29th.
I don't think he's going to get it.
Yeah.
I don't.
He's got a majority. So if all of the BC NDP vote with him, it can squeak through. The Indigenous people, three chiefs have come forward and said they have been in contact with the three chiefs since they made statements saying that they don't agree with this bill. It's not that they don't agree with the bill per se, it's that they're more upset that they weren't consulted before the bill was written.
And it's not mentioned in there. I think he has an easy fix here. Yeah. All he has to do is write in there what he said.
Yeah.
I'm not trusting anybody. If they're saying sign this, Don't worry, this is what it means. If it's not in black and white, this means nothing, especially from a politician. Come on.
And that's the argument of the Green Party. They're saying that while we don't think that the NDP would do anything nefarious, we want to see it in black and white.
Yeah, so do I, honestly. Yeah. So do I, even though I don't believe he would. Yeah. 100%, I would not support this unless it was written in there.
Yeah.
Seriously, if he's willing to say it, why isn't he willing just to put that in there? The guy was a lawyer.
He didn't write the bill, though. Ma did.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
He didn't write the bill, just like Adrian Dix wrote Bill 14. There's a few of them that all work together. All those bills work together. The Indigenous chief said, all we have to do is sit down and we can get through this. We can come to an agreement that we like. It's an easy fix. We can get there. Ma's argument is, and I see her point, is that we need to build. We need to build fast. We have not been building fast enough. We have not been building schools. We have not been building hospitals. We need infrastructure. Our infrastructure does not match our population growth. And she's looking at it from, we just want to get a yes or no very quickly on things like schools and hospitals and clinics and things like that, that we absolutely do need. We don't need to have 5 years of consultation before we put shovels in the ground, is her argument. And I get that and I understand that, but we need to do it the right way.
Yeah, I think that if that's the goal, I agree with that. Why not just write it in that you're going to make sure that you have the consent of the Indigenous leaders and that you're not going to touch pipelines LNG or whatever?
But because under UNDRIP, it's the law that they have to be consulted before the project happens. If it's going to affect them, they will be consulted. That mechanism is there. It's just not in this particular bill. They want a definition around what those projects are. I think that's a valid concern. And a lot of the criticism is not necessarily directed towards the NDP. It's the concerns about what future governments could do with this legislation that may not be as principled or willing to further reconciliation like the BC NDP is.
So that gets voted at the end of the month?
They break for summer, May 29th, and he's trying to get it passed before then. Okay. So we'll have to
we'll have an update.
Yeah. So then we got about 5 minutes before questions. And so then we can talk about Trump's big, beautiful bill and his birthday parade.
So the bill failed. And he's been talking about this bill, this big, beautiful bill that had, I believe it spoke to some cuts in Medicare. And five Republicans voted against it. And he was not, he was all caps tweeting. Yeah. He's not happy. And then he threatened a 65% tax increase on Twitter.
It's led by Chip Roy. There's five of them that are the most right wing in the government, and they want to slash Medicaid. That's the problem. They don't think that the cuts to Medicaid go far enough. Yeah. Yeah.
You can't make this up, eh? What a disaster.
Chip Roy is awful. Chip Roy is one of the worst down there, and they want to gut Medicaid. Is what they want to do. Until Johnson agrees to those cuts, they will not vote for the bill. And they warned them in advance that they would not vote for this bill. They did warn them. And Johnson went ahead and tried to get it passed anyways. So now Trump's going to bully them on Truth all weekend, and he's going to whip up the base, and they're going to get death threats and all that kind of stuff until they comply, because that's the way they govern down there now.
Speaking of the comply, Bruce Springsteen, we'll talk about that in a second. He's, oh, let's see how it is when you're back in the country. But anyways, the military parade, his birthday happens to fall on the anniversary of their military or something important. I think it's in the marketing. I think they would have spent a lot of money on a parade anyways.
Yeah, it's celebrating 250 years of the military is what it is. But they're touting it as Trump's birthday parade.
That's it. The marketing of it, which feels so North Korean-ish.
Way to take from veterans and military personnel.
Yeah.
Make it about you.
Yeah. I just wrapped up a 5-part documentary series on the Vietnam War. And I'll tell you, after watching that, I do not have a very good opinion of the military in the U.S. at all. What they did and continue to do to the people that served for them is horrific, horrific. But yeah, apparently they're going to have all kinds of tanks and fighter jets, and they're housing like 7,500 military personnel in Washington for this thing. And it's all the bells and whistles, all the bells and whistles, while they're denying little kids cancer treatment and deporting 2-year-olds to Venezuela and welcoming.
And spending so much money on that, that the Department of Homeland Security is going to be broke by July.
Yeah, it's just the priorities down there. It's so hard watching it.
It is hard to watch. It is hard to watch. And I hate to say this, but I think that we have a real benefit of being able to watch it so that we know what to protect ourselves from in our country, because we're really close. Yeah. I hate to say that, but I want to protect us. I don't want what's going on there. I don't.
No. And they're trying to get a toehold in Alberta.
Yeah.
We can talk about that more on Tuesday.
Yeah, we'll talk more about Alberta separation on Tuesday. But let's wrap today talking about some celebrities. Jan Arden. All the algorithm of political Canadian TikTok, all the Canadian right media slamming Jan Arden. How dare Jan Arden? And she's retweeting the stuff. She thinks it's awesome.
Yeah. And you know what? I think it's great. It's the same thing that happened to Eminem when he endorsed Kamala, right? Yeah. Every time somebody on the right finds out that their favorite musical artist is actually a leftist, or at the very least a humanitarian, they absolutely freak out. And it's art is political.
But
art is political.
So, yeah, that's true. I do the same when I find out, like, I wasn't a big Nickelback fan before, but then when I found out that they're going on that tour, I really disliked them more. I really did.
Oh, I've always disliked Chad Kroeger from his time living in Vancouver and in Langley. I dislike him greatly. I remember him getting caught doing like 140, 180 and drunk and getting off with a warning.
Entitlement.
Yeah.
Wow, they're really going after Jan Arden.
Yeah. Probably doesn't help that she's a woman either, because they didn't go after Neil Young like that. They were mad at Neil Young, but
Jan.
Yeah, there she is.
It's only a minute long.
Hey, Alberta. Hey, a bunch of fucking separatist wackos. How you doing? Feeling good about yourselves? You're an embarrassment to this country. Everything you have, everything that you have enjoyed, cherished, and benefited from comes from being part of one of the greatest countries on the planet. You guys have your heads so far up your asses that you obviously can't see what pricks you are. The way you are treating Indigenous people, the way you are treating your fellow citizens, your fellow Canadians, you guys are a bunch of creepy little pricks. Alberta will never separate from Canada. It's never going to happen, because people like me are going to stand up, throw their shoulders back, and keep fucking yelling and keep standing up for what I know is right.
I love Jen.
And Bruce Springsteen's on tour in Europe right now. And yeah, he had spoke.
Yeah. Sorry. No, I saw it. I saw the clip.
He had a clip where he was speaking against Trump, and Trump posted about it, something about, we'll see what it's like when you're back in the country or something. Some people saw it as like a veiled threat. Mm-hmm. I wish we saw more celebrities speaking out. You mentioned briefly Neil Young. Mm-hmm. Neil Young had endorsed Carney. You said something about Michael Bublé talking about.
Oh, yeah. When he hosted the Junos, he was very elbows up and Canada first, and Canada will never be the 51st state. Yeah. I am a little disappointed that more Canadian celebrities are living in Canada aren't speaking up.
I'd also like to say that the whole Mike Myers, a lot of people are saying that because Mike Myers' name came up at jury selection, that doesn't mean he's fucking guilty. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Anyways, why don't we get through our questions and then wrap it up?
Yeah, sounds good.
Gracie says,
why does Scheer need to move at all, as he is interim? They have houses. Yeah, the opposition should be for MP. The thing about Stornoway is that it actually has a set of legislation around it and rules and regulations around it. And it's actually administered by another organization. I can't remember exactly what it's called, but there are rules and regulations and legislation around Stornoway. And it is specifically that the leader of the opposition is the only one who can live in Stornoway, according to the legislation.
And so, it's been like that since the 50s, I think.
Yeah. We're one of the only jurisdictions in the world that supplies housing for the leader of the opposition, which I don't think we should. But that's a different conversation for a different time.
I think we should pay some taxpayer money to fix up 24 Sussex, if I'm being honest. I think we should.
Yeah.
I think it's embarrassing that it's in that kind of shape.
Yep. Yeah.
So then there's Jaden, and his comment is oppositional, but he also has some very good comments in here. So his question, I think, mm-hmm. is legit. I think.
Yeah, okay.
It's not meant to. So he's wondering, why did Pierre Poilievre fail if the Conservatives got 8 million of the votes?
Because he didn't win. Seriously, that's the answer. He didn't win. The goal of the election wasn't to do better. It was to win. Mm-hmm. Getting better, that's just to pat yourself on the back for feeling better about losing. But the fact is that he failed because he didn't win. I can't make it more simple than that.
And actually, it's hypocritical that he gets to keep his leadership, because both Scheer and O'Toole also grew the vote share, also grew the number of seats, also won the popular vote. They both won the popular vote. And
both got booted.
And both got booted. He didn't even win the popular vote. He didn't win the popular vote. He didn't win his seat. And he didn't win the election.
Yeah. So the credit that he's getting is the same credit that was deserved by two other leaders who kept their seats and still got kicked out of the party. If anybody else wants in on that bet, you let me know.
And the Liberals also had record low number of votes.
Yeah.
So to say that he got 8 million votes, so he gets a door prize, it's false equivalency, because the Liberal Party also grew their vote share and got the popular vote and won the election.
If all the extra votes had come from the Liberals, maybe you have a better argument. but they didn't. They did exactly what the liberals did, except liberals did something better because they won. They succeeded in the goal of an election. And the goal of an election isn't to do better than last time. It's to win, period.
Yeah.
And he didn't.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Jaden, the question you should be asking is, how do we make more money so that houses are affordable relative to income? 20 years ago, houses were 4 times our yearly income, and now it's only 10 times.
Okay, hang on a second. If the private sector was going to solve the housing affordability crisis, they would have done it by now. Free market is not going to solve this. Yes, there is wage inequality. Yes, we need to bring up our wages, but no.
Let's stick to that though. How do you do that? Because that's what I'm getting out of the question. I'm getting the how do we get people to earn more money question. I think personally, my opinion would be stronger support of unions, because without unions, the companies aren't going to give raises as generously as unions. They're not going to give benefits. They're not going to be as generous to their staff. It would be a nice warm and fuzzy world to believe otherwise. But the reality is that because of unions, we have people who are making more money and getting more benefits from it. That would be my answer, would be to push for more unions.
But you also need government intervention in the free market. The reason why we're in the problems that we're in right now is because we have let the free market run rampant with limited government interventions. We used to have much more government interventions in our free market. In BC here in the 70s, you couldn't build a construction project for the government if you weren't unionized. You couldn't actually get a construction job unless you were part of a union. That was changed by Bill Vandersam and the Social Credit Party. They chipped away at it, chipped away at it, chipped away at it, just like they chipped away at the necessity for people to be part of unions for grocery stores and stuff like that. Grocery stores used to be like a really good job. It was a really good job. If you got a job at Safeway, if you got a job at Safeway,
No, I'm being serious. It still is.
No, but not according to the Safeway manager I was talking to, because we were talking about that about a year ago. He said, nobody wants to stay here anymore because they don't pay like they used to. You can't have a full-time, like you used to be able to do a full-time job as a cashier and put food on your table and a roof over your head and all of that because you were paid appropriately for the work that you did. But that changed when they, especially when they started doing things like permanent part-time so that they didn't have to pay benefits. They busted unions, et cetera, et cetera.
Probably indicative of Safeway and not the entire grocery industry, but we can bring that up on Tuesday if you want, considering I was in there for 30 years.
Yeah, no, and I understand that, but you have to remember you were in management. You weren't working as a cashier putting food on your
I understand.
Table.
I'm the one who explained all of the union contracts every time that they got renewed.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. But we're way past the time anyways.
Yeah.
So let's get through some more questions and then we can bring that up again on Tuesday.
We're just
going
to do two more. Does the government realize they have a fiduciary responsibility to consult Indigenous people?
Yes. They're not saying that they're not going to consult on projects afterwards. He came out and admitted they made a mistake by not sitting at the table discussing the bill before it was written with First Nations.
I was going to say, when I went back to when Pierre was slamming the housing minister right out of the gate with bullshit, pardon me, that's not going to help. And I hope that conservatives who support him recognize what's needed in this moment. This isn't because my guy won and your guy lost or whatever. This is what needs to be done right now in a time of economic change. And you can criticize what Carney's doing, what you want, but please recognize that Pierre is purposely still trying to campaign against this guy instead of doing what was just left in the comment, which is working together for what is best of the citizens. Is it in the citizens' best interest, Pierre, to bullshit about whose fault Vancouver pricing is, to put doubts in the minds of Carney's picks for the ministers? There's a legitimate criticism. Sure, hear it. Let the housing minister make a decision first. Don't give him shit for something that isn't his fault to cast doubt in Canadians' minds at a time where we do need to be unified against an economic threat. Okay, my rant is over.
Yeah. No, and I think that that's another thing that really is sticking in my craw right now is this is just, let's wait. Let's
wait. Who under 50 says that? Anybody? I say it too, but it's an old person saying. Anyway, what's sticking in your craw, girl?
That everybody's on the attack already. They haven't even sat in Parliament. They've barely done anything. They haven't really done too much. And everybody is looking to pick it apart. Like, everybody's looking.
They're still campaigning.
Yeah.
It's like they're still campaigning. And I'm hoping, geez, let's get this by-election over. Let's get this guy a seat so that we can get over that part. I hope, if it never stops, that Pierre continues down this attack route, especially when he isn't factual. I hope that his supporters recognize that and recognize how that does more harm than good. The whole country. This isn't about a my team, your team thing. This is about our damn country.
Yeah. All of us together.
All of us together. Okay, now I'm going to wrap it up. It is quarter after already. Thank you very much for joining us on the Maple Minds podcast today. Join us on Tuesday when we're going to be live next.
See you Tuesday, everyone.
Bye, everyone.